Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Exchange, the acquired taste in masonry. This is the 25th day of the year, and we're celebrating all over the place, aren't we? It's for all of the Russian students out there. I wish you a most wonderful Tatiana Day. This is. Not to be neglected when such a large group of people are having such a wonderful time. It started off as a religious holiday, like a lot of things, and it's observed on the 25th of January, according to the Georgian calendar, and the 12th of January, according to the Julian. You know, it does make a difference. This has to do with Ivan Shuvalov's mother, Tatiana Rodionova, his mistress, Empress Elizabeth of Russia, endorsed his petition to establish a university in Moscow. So the Shuvalov was the Minister of Education. That's the connection here. Sorry about that. So the Russian Orthodox Church, the education being primary, traditional service went on at the university's church, and the Russian Orthodox Church declared Saint Tatiana the patron saint of students. So today, students across, university students across Russia celebrate. They get together, they party, they drink, they eat, and it's. In 1885, remember the incredible writer, Chekhov? He wrote, "This year everything was drunk except the water from the Moscow River, and only because it was frozen. Parties began with a traditional honey-based mead. But it started in Moscow, and it spread to most of the university towns." What a wonderful idea. So all of the students, best of luck across Russia. Best of luck with your studies in the upcoming semester, and we wish you the best of good fortune. Now, the rest of this mayhem for the 25th of January is wonderful. At a time when in our part of the planet, it tends to be we're getting into the dog days of winter, aren't we? Groundhog Day is just around the corner. We're looking for some symbols of change coming up. St. Patrick's Day is coming, about 50 days, 49 days until the equinox, the spring equinox. So what we're thinking that we're wrapping our scarves a little tighter around our necks right now, it's like everything else, it passes enormously quickly. And it gives us those chapters in our lives that mark off the beginning and end of years. And now the sun is being restored to us. The light is being restored to us, all you metaphysicists out there. And new life, new growth, warmth. The world is in a constant state of change. I have something. Cyril didn't leave a whole lot for his firstborn grandson, except, as I've explained before, when I was a very little boy, he was teaching me I didn't realize it at the time. He was teaching me the values and principles of masonry. You know, it's, these things come back when you start to think about the long walks you had with your grandpa. And the time when we were, he had me working with him in the fields and in the woods. And when my uncles were teaching me how to fish for trout in the streams on their farm property. This is like, oh, this is like boy's world. It's just incredible memories. One thing that did come to me was a book, the Robbie Burns Collected Works, the poems. This is a 1900 production. And what I'm doing here is I'm just flipping to the page, a little bit of pencil in his hand in the front page. He wrote about, he wrote down a little bit about Burns. Burns was born on the 25th of January, 1759, and he died on the July 21st, 1796. What does that make him? It makes him, what, 37 years old. So, you know, he wasn't around that long. And he also writes, this is a, well, this surprised me, because I always thought that Lord Byron was a bit edgier, you know. And right under this, yes, he in his hand, Byron, born January 27th, 1788, and died April 19th, 1894, at age, age 36. So he was a fan. I haven't found the Byron book of his. But I'm reading here in a little bottom, in a little bubble he put, page 274. Here it is. This is, I'll try and read around the old English here. I beg your forgiveness. The rat and dog, the daddy o't. I composed this song pretty early in life and sent it to a young girl, a very particular acquaintance of mine who was at the time under a cloud. Oh, my baby clouts will die. Oh, will tempt me when I cry. Woe will kiss me when I die, the ranting dog, the daddy ought. But what will own we did the fuck? Or what will buy the groaning mutt? Or what will tell me how to cut the ranting dog, the daddy ought? Then I mount the creepy stair. What will sit beside me there? Kill me, Rob. I'll seek no more, the ranting dog, the daddy. What will crack to me my lane? What will make me fidget fain? What will kiss me o'er again? The ranting dog, the daddy ought. What did Cyril find in that? I read it and read it and read it. But it was, maybe it's the reason that it was in here. Composed to a young girl, an acquaintance of Burns, who was under a cloud. So he was trying to cheer her up. I'll get back to reading another piece in here as we go through the show. But, you know, I'm not going to tie that up. This is a day when I don't have anything planned to go in the tartan. I don't mind wearing the gram and ever. And one day I must get around to petitioning Grand Lodge to ensure that it is proper and fit wear for any lodge meeting. You know, as we have all our little restrictions and thou shalts and who cares. I'd like to see that corrected here. Today, we're going to talk a bit more about the first charge, just in case we were starting to make things too much interesting, the interest was just going over the top. You know, it's hard to chew over such topics over and over and over again and remain enthusiastic about them unless there's something to be said, something a little edgy. So come with me on this walk. Be sure that we are of a like mind. They're on the same page. I hope you're drinking copious amounts of whatever warms your heart and mind right now. Matthew Arnold was an English poet and cultural critic. He was born on the 24th of December, 1822, and he lived until 1888. But some of his work is just his work. I won't say some. Who's that? It's not as if I've been a scholar and read all of his work, but his material is remarkable, just remarkable. I'll pull up what Wikipedia has to say about this guy. But the point of this is there is a point. He became one of the leaders of what was called the Oxford Movement. Now, if anything matters in Masonry, I think it's the work of some key intellectuals. The look at the history that we're studying of the craft history and what the subtext is always about to put what we're reading into a context. The assumption that the charges and obligations and everything were written with the same translation, the same meaning as we pull from them today, would, I think, be a mistake. As we know, different culturally, there's different influences that change the way we think about certain phrases. Now, if I say to you, Charlie Hebeau, je suis Charlie Hebeau, you 3 weeks ago, that would have had no resonance. Today, it has a deep, deep grasp on our principle of freedoms. And it comes from the country who, on behalf of the world, epitomizes that that effort and the sacrifice, which tells us the importance of these freedoms. So all of a sudden, meaning out of a simple phrase, je suis, Charlie. That's what I'm getting at with the way that the obligations were written. And you know that I believe very strongly in following the original local traditions, not yours and mine that we've spun to over top of them. Those don't make any sense to me. They have no provenance. They're just a whim, and usually based on something that makes no sense anymore. So I adhere to the original local traditions, and I'm a proponent of the ancient charges. I think they should be moved front and center in every book of the work, because and Book of Constitution, because that gives us the guidance we need to fulfill our constitutional obligations. So anyway, all of that aside, what Arnold talked about was criticism and curiosity, and he made a connection between them that holds us in good stead. It frees the mind from some of the silliness, that silly neuroses. Oh, you're criticizing me, therefore you don't love me, therefore I'm somehow unfulfilled, or I don't like you. That kind of thinking just makes grown men look silly. My goodness. So if we're trying to overcome that, at least we say we do, whether we really do or not, because it's such a familiar mantra. If I act a little grumpy, nobody will know I'm really, thinking sideways on this. But he was talking about criticism and curiosity. Criticism, the function of criticism, is noticeable that the word in which other languages is used is a good basis for understanding criticism. Nobody ever sat down with me and said, here, this is something that's going to happen almost every day of your life. You're going to hear it. We want to tell you a little bit about the function of it. You figure it out. Many objections have been made to a proposition which, in some remarks of mine on translating Homer, I ventured to put forth, a proposition about criticism and its importance to the present day, says Matthew Arnold. Of the literature of France and Germany, of the intellect of Europe in general, the main effort for these many years has been critical effort. The endeavor in all branches of knowledge, theology, philosophy, history, art, and science is to see the object as in itself it really is. I added that owing to the operation of English literature of certain causes, almost the last thing for which one would come to English literature is just that very thing which now Europe most desires, criticism, and the power and value of English literature was thereby impaired. What he tells us here, and this study is worth getting and reading through, is that still less is this to be expected from men addicted to the composition of the false or malicious criticism of which Wordsworth speaks, right? So remember, criticism, is it valid or is it malicious or is it false? The latter two, different context, intellectually. Malicious criticism is something that we can be addicted to, addicted to the composition. So watch the man. These types of statements, criticisms from other people, define the speaker. They have nothing to do with you. They define the speaker. They define character. This is what these writers of the 19th century are telling us. Best we pay attention, But it is true, says Arnold, that criticism is really in itself a baneful and injurious employment. It is true that all time given to writing critiques on the works of others would be much better employed if it were given to original composition of whatever kind this may be. It is true that Samuel Johnson, had better have gone on producing more Irene, good, read that, instead of writing his Lives of the Poets, his criticisms. But so full of criticism and criticism of the works of others, where Arnold takes this idea is that it has to do with curiosity and the perfection of curiosity. That's the power. The critical power is of lower rank than the creative, right? The critical power, whether malicious or false, that put down, that critique of somebody else's work is of lower rank, less important than the creative power. It is undeniable that the exercise of a creative power, that is, free creative activity, is the highest function of man. It is proved to be so by man's finding in it his true happiness. But it is undeniable also that men may have the sense of exercising this free creative activity in other ways than in producing great works of literature or art. If it were not so, all but a very few men would be shut out of the true happiness of all men. It's the perfection of curiosity, the need to know, the need to have answers for the questions. And in that, in true, I think, unadulterated, unashamedly and unabashedly candor, Arnold tells us this is the true, where you begin to find true happiness. Now I have to stop this now. It's too early in the show to get off on this kind of a tangent. But think about it. Criticism as a form of perfecting curiosity, altogether different context. That's what makes this, I think, there's the exchange part of what we're doing today. So have at it. Think about it a little bit. as we're going through this work. Because and that's what we want in Masonic Exchange, is to draw out those ideas, the powerful ideas, and to help examine them. And I don't, we may be off your examining and reading in your own way, but here we can have the discussion, the talk back. One-sided, yeah. But you're not likely to hear this type of thing in most lodges, are you? And always to draw ideas and draw notions forward. Today, I think we've got an interesting, we're pointing out the mystery, we're pointing out the mystery to a Mason. We're not telling the mysteries of a Mason. So what kind of a rant did we go on with this? Tell me what you think about this one. I think this is preface made me think, made me sit down and stop, and the readings behind it, this research I was doing on it, made me stop and approach my work, my sonic work, and my work around me in my life much differently, and in a good way. It helped me to answer some questions, and I hope it's not like I have the secret here. That's the key. This is no secret. This is out there. It's just, it's like, has anybody ever taught you to think about the power and context of criticism? Well, no. Maybe if we went to old school, maybe if we're in the University of Glasgow or Oxford, or, you know, maybe with those older approaches to education, where we're reading in particular subjects, we would discover this. Maybe as students of English, of literature, where we don't mock what we don't know, we begin to realize these are what? Beautiful metaphors, beautiful expressions of that merger of idea. The expression of emotion in poetry is much better than anything we can do in our lives. It is a language all on its own. Profane might rarely experience what a Mason experiences, whether together or after making its own way home. Being true to his obligations, he exists in a constant state of vigilance. Now, this, I don't think, is attention. It's paying attention. If you decide what that means is that this is a person that's gripping their hands together, white-knuckled, or walking around, wondering what peril is going to be around the next corner. Well, no. It's that person that's risen above it all and is paying attention no matter what they do. Somebody tells you that it's the dark corners or there must be danger in there. This is the mind. It says, really? Where's your proof? It's just dark. Danger and darkness, unless you present it there. And if there's something unpredictable, you'll react to it, won't you? But better that you stretch that out and become a walking billboard for anxiety. Being true to his obligations, he exists in a constant state of vigilance. How can that be, you say? Yeah. How can anyone be aware every moment of every day? The secret isn't so secret once you know it, but here it is. It is likening learning to a bag full of goals. Some are short-term, some are small. Others are life goals and consume great energy. To be vigilant is to be mindful of what goal you are capturing in that moment. This is what we call awareness. Enjoying what we do. Awareness. Realizing there's a point. There's a meaning. We're doing stuff. We're paying attention. Aude vide tace. I keep going back to a wonderful motto for the Grand Lodge of Canada. If Freemasonry has secrets, this is one out there for all to see. In a sense, hidden in public until a passerby notices and begins to connect. We've made mistakes trying to understand what to do with it. We have manners that guard us against that. Where you get blindsided is dealing with the illusion. The illusion is about a quiet nature. While brethren are preoccupied analyzing to understand, they may appear aloof and haughty. But they're preoccupied. So, do we have goals? In a sense, if we look at ourselves, are they with us constantly? In a sense, they are. But this is to suggest that as we go through our day, we're aware of this. Just like when we go out, if you're lost in your own head, if you're living inside your own head with your thoughts bleak, selecting evidence from your experience that proves the dangers that you perceive. The dangers have never been any more or less. They've always been there. Just waiting for that moment to arrive. So we go forward with choices in mind. We're going to live fearfully if that's the way you are. The world isn't like that. That's your choice. But in your own mind, look at the goals that you have. For enrichment, the opportunity within Masonry is for us to come together to face these challenges. And what we see around us is a lot of people that are approaching this like they're waiting for teacher to tell them to pick up the book and read it. Well, you are the teacher. You are the master of your life, huh? If you want to progress, what does that require? You already know. It requires work. It requires thought. It requires being with people that can inspire and help you take steps toward your goals, Masonic or otherwise. And I think that distinction between Masonic and otherwise is invisible. Because what we do in Masonry should be so apparent in our everyday life outside of Lodge. At least we're told that. Remember, Masonic Exchange, we subscribe to the idea that the function of Lodge is to provide a sacred environment in which we study, in which we contemplate the importance and the messages of life that will help us to achieve a better understanding. That's it. Nothing malevolent. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. But we've chosen openly and without coercion, without being coerced, to step in that we want to, that we like that environment. But remember, too, there is no shoulds inside. The next man should not be thinking. If the majority of people, and the majority of people will not get everything. Remember, we write about and great ideas and great minds talk about the differences in ability. Why are we not all generals? Why are we not all physicists? Skills and ability vary. I won't get into why that is. It is. It is what it is. For some, the achievement of expressing those abilities is a steeper mountain to climb than it is for others. But it is always a challenge. Always. And that's the wonder of it all. Do you accept that challenge? And so it becomes a little tighter. Our conscience becomes a little tighter in masonry because we begin to look into the mirror and say, there's our own worst enemy. That's what's holding me back. And how many of the artists and the poets out there that I've met are aware of their circumstance, perfectly aware, and are finding happiness within their existence. They're not princes or poets, and they don't feel that they're a failure because they aren't. They found something that all men aspire to, or should, I guess. That inner happiness, that contentment. So, here's the mystery pointed out to a Mason. The secrets are right there. It's like the secrets of existence. They're there around us if we know what to look for. The truths are there if we care to admit them. But that means we've taken that step from criticism into the purity of curiosity, pure knowledge. So that's a little bit chewy for today. Enough. That's like pouring béarnaise sauce all over everything you eat. It's wonderful, but you don't want that on everything, do you? Today, later, I hope you'll find a glass of wine or champagne and toast to Robbie Burns. Now I'm going to get on with a bit of work here. I actually have to work for my keep around here. It's startling here. This is I'm working from some quotes by Seneca the Elder. Yep, hard to believe. He says, consult your friend on all things, especially on those which respect yourself. His counsel may then be useful where your own self-love might impair your judgment. As for old age, embrace and love it. It abounds with pleasure if you know how to use it. The gradually declining years are among the sweetest in a man's life. And I maintain that even when they have reached the extreme limit, they have their pleasure still. There is nothing more despicable than an old man who has no other proof than his age to offer for his having lived long in the world. Here's what he says about drunkenness. Drunkenness is nothing but voluntary madness. He says, the bravest sight in the world is to see a great man struggling against adversity. Wow. Those who boast of their descent brag on what they owe to others. No one is better born than another, unless they are born with better abilities and a more amiable disposition. He who boasts of his descent praises the deed of another. And Seneca talks about the silly bugger in us all. Anger is like those ruins which smash themselves on which they fall. The deferring of anger is the best antidote to anger. Defer it. Don't stop, but defer it. Put it on a hold. I'll be angry with you later. The greatest remedy for anger is delay. Anger, an acid that can do more harm to the vessel in which it is stored than to anything on which it is poured. You know, really starts to annoy me after a while when the Greek, this is a Roman we're talking about here, the philosophers, put out those ideas that tell me how what I'm doing to myself. And they're right. You know, I just, it's annoying. Don't you find that annoying? I find that enormously annoying. A little bit of, can we talk a little bit about the first term chart? Is that all right? We revisited a bit of that last week. Nice response to the work that we've been doing about the first constitution, by the way. Thank you very much out there to all the exchangers, Masonic exchangers. Nice work. I really interesting. Who knew that Anderson would have just made it up? Well, he met the deadline, didn't he? He'll go out there and create it. You only have this much time. And by the way, taking an enormous amount of information from all kinds of places and pull it together and produce something that's coherent. That's all. You know? And by the way, thank you. And I'm guessing he got the usual Masonic payment for that deed. So what do you do? First thing you do is to say, are you crazy? This is going to take a generation to do. Or is it going to take a couple of centuries to do? No, the guy delivered. Good Presbyterian minister that he was. He delivered. And how did he deliver? Made some stuff up. Hey, we need an explanation here. What's it going to be? Well, they brought all the early Masons onto the ark. Noah made a whole floor for them. He made a lodge inside that ark. All that livestock and the smell and the crap that was going on, well, it wasn't really there. 1717, the period that we really want to sink our teeth into. We remember now we had been through the trials of Galileo. We saw what those interesting superstitious little priests did to him, isolated the man. You know? We saw that his genius became more renowned after his death. That had been out of the way. The repeated plagues, the fire in London, you know, the realization that life was changing. Some social reform was going on. Reform of the rights of orphans and people that were injured on jobs. Some reform to resolve the dire poverty. Remember our friends in France during this period, it was before the French Revolution. And that extreme wealth and the utter poverty and hunger that was going on inevitably came to a collision. Oh my goodness, isn't that what's happening today around the world? If you think that this is just going to be resolved in a very friendly kind of a way, overall, the history of mankind doesn't show it. It becomes a forced march. It becomes open and conflicted. That does no longer work. That imbalance has always been part of the significant cultures of the world. Whether people can be placated, not so much anymore. Thomas Wise paraphrases Bacon like this. I say with a noble statesman that as a little philosophy inclines man's mind to atheism, with depth in philosophy brings men's minds about to religion, so that they are only the superficial and not the truly learned in physic, as built upon philosophy. Physic refers to, remember the doctors of physic? The people, the early doctors, the surgeons. Well, they didn't actually put hands on people to do all the cutting. They had these folks that were more like the butchers, remember? And the physic, doctor of physic, back in the time of Vercellius, it was still spouting Galen, you know, Galen's work. 14 centuries, they kept referring to Galen's work. Really, these weren't folks that could cut into things and see for themselves what was going on inside the body, but they speculated. So Vesalius was still doing it, and this is what was being taught in to doctors, 16th century. And they were guessing, and the doctor would sit up very high in a big high chair, and his title was Cathedra, and he would be reading to the students from the book quite often, you know, the work of Galen. And then Vesalius came along, and you were expecting some reform, which did eventually occur. But they were known as doctors of physic, and that's what we're talking about here. As built upon philosophy, who are justly liable to that imputation, and indeed that physicians of all men should be such fools, who would suppose as great a stupidity in them as if the mechanic who is employed in setting to rights the springs and movements of a watch should fancy with himself that what so often needs his hand to mend and put in due order, yet had no maker. Oh, I'm glad that Francis Bacon made that simple. Others who were comparing God to a watchmaker, this does come together, sorry, brethren, but it does. Others also were comparing God to a watchmaker. You know the mechanics of how the world is fit together? If you're struggling against the superstition, well, it is because it is. You know, heaven's up there and hell is down there, and yeah, they do exist. Well, then this came along, this notion like the orbits. Galileo challenged us with this. He said, well, you know, they weren't little perfect circles. And oh my goodness, the earth does move. Well, that just wasn't going to wash. The earth does not move. It's the center and everything moves around it. Well, then, you know, Kepler came along and what did he find? That in fact there were orbits with satellites around certain planets, and those, that whole process was also orbiting around other stars. At the time, it was a tremendous challenge. It was fascinating early on until the clergy got into it. It said, oh, no, this is really heretical. The scripture doesn't agree with that. All truth comes from the scripture, doesn't it? Lord? And the king would say, well, yes, of course. This is the final arbiter of our understanding of the universe. Watchmaker. Among them, Bernard Nuent, a Dutch philosopher, mathematician, physician, magistrate, and theologian. Really, when I hear this list of what these guys are doing, I'm thinking, really? Really? Did you get your education in the back of a matchbook? Not that I should ever betray my obligation to these fellows. In 1715, he published a book called The Right Use of the World Views for the Conviction of Atheists and Infidels. In 1718 and 1719, its several volumes appeared in an English translation by John Chamberlain. The title was The Religious Philosopher, or The Right Use of Contemplating the Works of the Creator Designed for the Conviction of Atheists and Infidels. The philosopher in the title is Nuent himself, called the Dutch Ray, because like those two English philosophers, he has so well proved the wisdom, power, and goodness of God by the strength of arguments. Ray and Derman had preceded Nuent in turning scientific observations into arguments for the existence and providence of God. John Ray wrote in The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of the Creation. They really liked long titles, didn't they? Several also had argued in favor of the truth of Christian revelation, but had done so on the basis of pure reason. Now, among these was Samuel Clarke. As my friend John points out, notice the E at the end. In 1704, he gave the Boyle Lectures called A Demonstration of the Being and Attributes of God, more particularly in answer to Mr. Hobbes, Spinoza, and their followers. I think Spinoza made a great deal of sense. They were so successful that he was asked to deliver the 1705 lectures as well, when he did under the title, A Discourse Concerning the Unchangeable Obligations of Natural Religion and the Truth and Certainty of Christian Revelation. Simple. Wonder what these guys did to have fun. Eh? Unlike Clark and others, Nguyen wanted to deduce revelation from scientific observations. Now help me, boys, bring this back to the first charge. He says that being ever done before in such a method, his novelty was much frowned upon. The translator writes, it were to be wished that he had applied the texts of Scripture, which he quotes, as properly as he had done his philosophical considerations. Eventually, Nguyen's observational arguments for a revelation were cut from the English translation altogether. Chamberlain explains, I have in this followed the advice of several of my learned friends, both philosophers and divines, to whom I communicated some of these sheets in a manuscript. These scientists, clergymen, were Samuel Clark, John Theophilus de Saulnier, the great philosopher Dr. Clark is mentioned explicitly in the dedication. As for de Saulnier, the letter of the translator by the Reverend J.T. de Saulnier has been part of the book and its title since the first print. In the nick of time, both learned friends must have convinced Chamberlain to leave out revelation from his translation and to change the title accordingly. In his letter of the 2nd February 1718, de Saulnier approves the omission of the arguments which Nguyen's eager zeal made him draw from the modern philosophy of revealed religion. He says, de Saulnier, when an atheist has the impudence to call himself a philosopher, some well-meaning persons that have not much looked into nature are apt to be prejudiced against the study of it. As if the philosophy and vain deceit against which the apostle has warned us had been the contemplation of the works of creation, whereas it was only the sophistry of the schools contrived to disguise error and defend the system of the superstitious heathen divinity. He then reads, Nguyen will easily see that a philosopher cannot be an atheist. If it were true that a smattering of physics will give a proud man a tincture of atheism, a deep search into nature will certainly bring him back to a religious sense of God's wisdom and providence. The last sentence is all but an unattributed citation from Bacon, and so is de Saulnier's referring to the apostle, which lacking Bacon's context stands rather isolated. So this really doesn't hang together. And as we go through it, it's really sort of ideas that are, you know, not necessarily obviously connected here. De Saulnier adopted Bacon's view that there are two levels of scientists. The superficial ones wandering off into atheism, and the profound ones returning to a religious sense of God's wisdom and providence. In view of these antecedents, there seems little doubt that Anderson's first charge does distinguish between deep and superficial Masons, those who rightly understand the art and those who don't. Gentlemen, what are they saying to us here? The deeper, they're saying that there's a distinction between the deep and superficial Mason. Moral law, positive law, and tenure. What we're getting into here should explain things to us. They're not wrong. There's nothing inferior. That is a path that those men, that's what they are. They are what they are, either deep or superficial. Not to be corrected, necessarily. Pine tree, oak tree. quartz granite. There, Anderson's contemporaries, on reading the words tenure and moral law, will automatically have added positive laws and have expected a binary exposition, first dealing with the moral law, then with positive laws. Also, they would have thought one particular context, the covenant of works between God and Adam, being the gracious agreement to give him eternal life and happiness upon condition of personal, perfect, perpetual obedience. That he should obey the moral law written in his heart, which was the general good of his obedience, and the positive law of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, that shalt not eat, which has the special trial of it. The distinction between moral law and positive law was common knowledge, extensively treated in church catechisms. The moral law, intrinsic to the nature of man, is proclaimed to all men by the natural light of reason, and binds all humans of all times. Positive laws, on the contrary, deal with practical religion then and there, and are not intended to be a standing rule of obedience for all nations in all ages. Adam was imposed a single positive law, not to eat of a particular tree. Later, the Jews had to live with a very elaborate set of positive laws. Anderson's tenure proved so tricky that the Dutch translation of 1736 simply skipped it. The word, you know that stuff that we were going through that didn't make any sense? It didn't make any sense from the beginning. Poor Anderson. The word, often met in the context of God's covenant with Adam, is a legal term meaning the conditions of an agreement concerning the original state of man and the very covenant of works. We read, the tenure by which, or the terms upon which, he was to hold his state. Intrinsic to tenure is the possibility of forfeiture. The title of Christ to eternal life is become absolute. By absolute, I mean discharged from all tenure or condition, and consequently from all forfeiture, and is in opposition to the first title of life delivered to Adam, which was held by tenure, as being received from God, and being so held, it became forfeited to him of whom it was held, according to the laws of tenure. Tenure is the first in the first charge, implies that the state of Mason is a temporary one, subject to the condition of obeying the moral law. Disobedience implies losing that state. So the moral law, what does that include? Besides the tenure, typically referred to God's covenant with Adam, the moral law also referred to God announced in the title of the first charge. There could not be a moral law without divine legislator, and we have not found any exception to that implicit conviction. Clark, dealing with deists, provides us with a striking, explicit catalog of the moral obligations, being the duties of morality in natural religion. There are seven obligations in natural religion, the first of which deals with God. Maybe we'll just finish with this one. I want to take a deep breath here. The seven are that all created rational beings, depending continually upon him, God, are bound to adore, worship, and obey him, to praise him for all things they enjoy, and to pray him for everything they want. Everything I want comes from, really? All right, we'll let that go. That they are obliged to promote in their proportion and according to the extent of their several powers and abilities, the general good and welfare of those parts of the world wherein they are placed. Okay. If you've got something to contribute, make it. Contribute it. That men in particular are everyone obliged to make it their business and a universal benevolence to promote the happiness of others. Moral law. Okay. that in order to this, every man is bound always to behave himself toward others, as in reason he would desire they should in all circumstances deal with him. The golden rule. Got that. That therefore he is obliged to obey and submit to his superiors in all just and right things, for the preservation of society and the peace and benefit of the public, to be just and honest, equitable and sincere in all his dealings with his equals. Oh, just, honest, equal and equitable and sincere in all his dealings with his equals. For the keeping inviolable the everlasting rule of righteousness, and maintaining a universal trust and confidence, friendship, and affection amongst men. Good times, being friendly. And towards his inferiors, to be gentle and kind, easy and affable, charitable and willing to assist as many as stand in need of his help. For the preservation of universal love and benevolence among mankind. Stretches the ideas of equality, doesn't it? And fraternity does. Makes him less of a cartoon or a pastiche, and more of a description of real life. And that the eighth, that in respect to himself, every man is bound to preserve as much as in him lies his own being and the right use of all his faculties, so long as it shall please God, who appointed him a station in this world, to continue therewith. That therefore he is bound to have an exact government of his passions, and carefully to abstain from all debaucheries and abuses of himself, which tend either to be destructive of his own being, or the disordering of his faculties, and disabling him from performing his duties, of hurrying him into the practice of unreasonable and unjust things. Don't be a silly bugger, it says. These obligations are summarized in three great principal branches, which from all the other and smaller instances of duty do naturally flow. These principal moral obligations are simple: piety, or men's duty toward God; righteousness, or the duty of men toward one another; and sobriety, a man's duty toward themselves. So he doesn't say not to do things or to do things. He's saying it's awareness. Didn't Seneca tell us that? Yeah, drunkenness is nothing but voluntary madness. So you drink, but not to the point of madness. There. The Greeks would be very pleased. So let's stop here. I find that, you know, I'm always a bit tense when I'm reading this type of thing. Why tension? Why tension? It seems like I'm talking about things that only adults talk about, or very serious-minded, the pious and grumpy. You know, if you're talking about this type of thing, and it's serious and important, it comes with being unpleasant, being grumpy, and not allowing any joy to happen around the discussion. That's the way I've been taught by the pious, the strict, you know, what is it, the Calvinists. This is the way, the pilgrim, this is the way it is. Dress in black, dress the same. Don't smile, don't dance, don't play cards, don't drink. Wow, is the world much, much different than all of that? Or what? Anyway, that's enough of that. That's enough of that. This is a... We celebrate being Masons. It's a remarkable challenge. It's a remarkable phenomena to be part of something that has more depth the more we look, the more we search for answers, the more background, the subtext within the subtext, the metaphor, the metaphysics, the esoteric, the more, if you look for it, men, and the distinctions here I don't know if they're calming, but they are affirming that we're hearing this work. Do I take this as valid? Yeah, I do. If I take anything as valid, if I've not lost all judgment, that there are scholars producing works that I should absorb. And we're not children. You know that notion of emotional maturity, when you begin to say and think things that are of your own mind, not parroting the comments or ideas of somebody else. Masonry allows us to do that, and it's daunting. I think we can agree. Why? I wonder, why would we do this to ourselves? Except the goal is so precious and so essential. Know thyself. Develop insight. Find that inner peace. Much better that we get distracted by dressing up, get distracted by prancing around, by bureaucracy, by where do the philosophers and the scholars, where do they fit in this? I've not heard them mentioned. In my experience out there, perhaps you have. Where are they? I think they don't exist, or they're marginal. So here, I'll leave you with this question today. Is this part of Masonry, or is this just blown smoke? Is the notions of the Masonic, the sacred Masonic, just too derivative and unessential, or is it the core of Freemasonry? Can we become comfortable acknowledging that trees in the forest fall down? Oh, we want them to stand up and grow and be fulfilled. Or do we say in a more mature way, some grow, some fall down? There's a distinction between people of, you see, we're having it described, people of ability, Masons of ability, Masons superficial, Masons deep. So when we walk through this world of Masonry, we don't walk through a monoculture. That we need to challenge that. That expectation is in our own mind. That only the those with ability will come, will be initiated. Well, they are. What should come along with that statement is, and there will be a lot of others who don't have the ability, but we can't tell. So we let them in, running the opportunity and the hope that they will be fulfilled and they will fulfill the mandate of Masonry. And quite candidly, I think the mandate of Masonry has always been held by a precious few minds. And if you are inclined to be one of the deep Masonic, then you will already understand this. You will already understand that your work, your effort, the way that you handle yourself and translate and interpret the principles and obligations of Freemasonry will leave an impression on the mind of newer, younger, more unsettled Masons that are coming behind us. And that this process has always been the way that we've conveyed the information. Now we have a fountain pen, now we have a printing press, now we have an internet. Does it really matter? None of that matters if you don't have anything useful to say. If you have nothing clever or useful that contributes, nothing that you write makes a damn difference. Nothing that we print and read on a page matters. So at a molecular level, you are Masonry. Holy crap. Who knew? Thank you very much for joining today. Thank you very much for listening in. Get in touch with me. I think we have a website going on, Masonic Exchange. Just it's exchange with an X, all one word, at gmail.com. This is your Masonic exchange. The information is filtered through, so I'm trying to piece together the best information, the valid information, and offer it to out there so that it contributes to the dialogue. Here's a bit of Scottish kind of stuff to leave us to part company today. This is by a Scottish singer and songwriter, contemporary, named Rachel Sermani, and she sings in Gaelic. So, no, this girl doesn't sing in Gaelic. She's singing traditional Scottish music, and she's been very, very influenced by Robbie Burns' poetry. As you listen to her, it's a little short piece called Song for a Fox. See what you think. Yes, I do listen to this stuff. Here. Thank you.
Scots in the audience, maybe from the government. Put yourselves for Thank you. Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and all last time? For all last time, my job, for all last time, will take a cup of kindness yet for all last time. And surely you'll be your best self, and surely I'll be mine, and we'll talk a cup of kindness yet for all last time. We walk a run up to the brave, and it's the cow. But we've won the money, a weary set, and all last time. We toyed a little in the bar before the sun died, but deep between us, brave rot. And there's a hand my trust it feels, and give a hand or dime, and we'll talk a right good will he what for all time. For